you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Before we get to our guest, I have an update for you on the Morning Edition Challenge. We had a goal of 400 members to unlock a $25,000 challenge, and we got the final numbers in. We heard from 398 members. We were two members shy. We just lost $25,000 that we cannot legally accept. Two listeners short of the goal. 398 people gave over the course of the morning. This is one of the most discouraging failures to meet a challenge I've ever seen at LAist. 398 with $25,000 at stake. Wow. Obviously, we can't do that for Air Talk today. That would be a loss of $45,000. We'll get to that in a moment, but we turn our attention to the financial challenges faced by the city of Los Angeles and whether the city is going to look at eliminating unfilled positions as one of the ways to help close the gap. That is a recommendation in a report from Chief Administrative Officer for the City of LA, Matthew Sabo, who joins us to talk about what's contemplated. Matt, thank you very much for being with us this morning.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
So let's talk first about what your office is estimating the size of the gap in the budget is going to be based on anticipated revenues and current expenditures.
So the city is facing a significant current year deficit, and that is largely due to spending that's over plan and revenue that's coming in way under plan. The city is very sensitive, or city revenue rather, is very sensitive to the economy. And what we're seeing is that although we're certainly not in a recession, the revenue streams that the city relies on are really softening at this moment. We rely heavily on sales tax, on business tax, on the taxes people pay when they stay in hotels, and taxes that are paid when you buy or sell property. And as I'm sure your listeners know, we've had a period of inflation over the past several years, and that's having an effect on consumer behavior. So we're seeing business taxes down and sales taxes down. We're seeing fewer stays in our hotels. And then, of course, the high interest rates are having a really devastating effect on the housing market. There's very little activity happening right now. And so that all contributes to the city's deficit. The mayor is currently developing her proposal for next fiscal year's budget. And what I reported to the council this week is that given our revenue challenges and rising expenditures, we are going to need to look at some reductions in that fiscal year 24-25 budget. That could include eliminating positions.
So let's talk about what the city's dealing with now, because in our conversations with the mayor, she's been very clear she wants to see hiring beefed up. She's concerned about how many open positions there are, because that's affected services, everything from parks and recreation to sanitation to so many different divisions within the city. If the city eliminates up to 2,000 unfilled jobs, then what does that mean for city services?
Well, the goal in this proposal is not to cut services, because clearly if the positions are unfilled, they are not performing any services today. However, we will not be able to continue to pay for or set aside money for thousands of positions that are unfilled and have been hard to fill, quite honestly, over the past several years. So the goal is that there wouldn't be a cut in services, but if we eliminate the vacant positions, it would be difficult to expand services certainly across the board. The mayor and the council could expand services, but they would have to prioritize to the most critical services.
You'd have a much deeper understanding than me, but my sense of the mayor in our conversations with her is that she was looking for services to be improved, because as listeners would call in and be complaining about things like dumping and getting response to potholes and all kinds of other things, she'd say, we have all these unfilled positions. We need to attract people to these jobs and hire people so that we can meet the need, because clearly we're not meeting the need across the board now. So I understand you're saying that eliminating open positions doesn't cut from where we are now, but my sense of the mayor was she didn't feel where we are now is in any way adequate.
Well, I think part of our strategy is to preserve the mayor and council's ability to prioritize, and that is part of the recommendations that we've made as it relates to how the city proceeds with hiring. The program is called Priority Critical Hiring. So there is a tiered system that will still allow elected leaders to hire up in areas that they deem most critical. We just are not in a financial position to hire across the board. So everything that the mayor said in terms of wanting to expand services, she and the council will still be able to do that in select priority areas. And that will be the discussion that we'll have for the remainder of this year, and certainly in development and approval of the budget for next year.
We're talking with Matt Szabo, who's joining us, the LA City Administrative Officer, talking with us about the budget challenge that the city faces. If you have questions for him, we're at 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. We heard from at least one council member, Eunices Hernandez, who is concerned about the loss of these positions because her, to paraphrase her perspective, she says her constituents care more about some of the services that are provided with these jobs that are unfilled than they do about the level of staffing of the LA Police Department. So are there unfilled positions within LAPD that would be subject to being cut?
Well, as you may have been hearing, LAPD is also down significantly. It's authorized for over 10,000 positions, and it is the current staffing level is less than 9,000. They have been facing the same hiring challenges, actually more acute hiring challenges than we've been seeing in the rest of the city. As it relates to the allocation of resources and the areas where the city would continue to hire or seek to expand, that is a policy decision and a policy debate that the mayor and council will have over the next several months. My job is to provide to them the financial picture and to let them know what we can afford broadly. And it's up to the mayor and council to make those priorities and to make those decisions.
We're talking with interim LAPD Chief Dominic Choi a couple of days ago, and I asked him about not filling those positions, and he said public safety is at risk. He said, I'm going to fight to keep those positions. We need to rebuild the size of the force because we've suffered a significant decline in the number of sworn officers over the past couple of years. So it sounds like he doesn't think they're going to be able to provide a necessary public service if they can't rehire from their current level of officers. What's your response to that?
Well, the issue with LAPD is a little bit different than we're seeing in the rest of the city. They have been struggling with hiring for the last several years, really significantly since 2020. And that is in part why the mayor and council moved forward with a contract that would make hiring easier or more attractive. Despite those efforts, hiring has been still slow, and attrition. There are more officers that are retiring than we've been able to hire. And so that is an issue that that the department and the city will continue to grapple with. And as it relates to, you know, well, I'll just say that in terms of our recommendations, we are not going to be recommending cutting any sworn positions. That said, the challenge at LAPD is simply being able to hire at the same pace as folks are retiring.
Well,
it's a separate issue.
And the other thing, if you're going to have the non-sworn personnel in the department significantly decrease or with positions that aren't able to be filled, there's a good chance sworn officers will end up doing much of that work that has to be done, and they're compensated at a higher rate on average than the people that historically have done those jobs. So you could see there could be a net loss there in that case.
And that's... you know, these issues that you're raising, Larry, are exactly why we are recommending measures to bring our expenditures in line with our revenues. If you're operating at a deficit, you know, these will be the challenges that we'll see for years to come. So we do need to reset our expenditures in line with our revenues. And then the city will have the ability, the elected leaders will have the ability to expand in areas where they deem as priorities as the economy rebounds and grows.
Matthew Szabo, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it very much.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Chief Administrative Officer for the City of Los Angeles, Matthew Szabo, talking about his report earlier this week to the LA City Council on how to deal with the hundreds of millions of dollars in budget gap the City of Los Angeles is facing.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. You ever wonder what a SIG alert is and what the history of it is? Well, it has an actual definition, and it evolved back in the 1950s, the brainchild of KMPC 710 radio station executive Lloyd Sigmund. That's how it got its name. But if you want to know more than just that, well, we have an LAist reporter to tell you all about it. Caitlin Hernandez, LA Explained reporter for LAist, has taken a deep dive. Caitlin, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So who was Lloyd Sigmund? What? How did he come up with this?
I think he was a very knowledgeable radio man, one of the classics. You know, before he was an executive, he kind of rose through the ranks of the station. He served for a time in, I believe, in our U.S. Army, doing some radio work there. So he had a lot of this manufacturing know-how of how radio waves work and tools to use them. So he ended up coming up with a specialized receiver that when it would receive a specific tone, it could have the ability to take a station off air and replace it with any kind of new information that could be broadcast in a different way. So, you know, he was really the mastermind behind it.
And of course, we have an emergency alert system now, which is much more technologically advanced, but a similar principle that if there's emergency information, that's able to be passed on from public officials and first responders and to be able to be put on broadcast stations.
Yes, definitely. And I wanted to preface, I think today SIG alerts, you know, they come through us like the radio stations. We use them. I know some of our hosts on like All Things Considered have gone and shared SIG alerts or some TV stations do. But back in the day when it first started, it would be a broadcast alert on the radio only. So it was really an interesting system.
Yeah. So how did it get more specialized to go from an emergency communication from law enforcement into one specifically designed for major traffic backups?
Definitely. So it actually, I wanted to share, it actually started, a lot of history picks up where, oh, this became a tool for the LAPD to use, which is part of the history. But if you go back just a few years further, it actually started as a way for civil defense officials to kind of take the radio waves and control if they needed to share some type of urgent update, like you're saying, similar to like the EAS system that we have. It's a Cold War era, design that they had in mind, but it did end up going into things like traffic alerts. So really, you know, Sigmund wanted to find, I think, a daily use for this type of machine, this type of tool to use. And the idea that came to mind was like, oh, well, you know, if I partner, we could try to partner with the LAPD, see if we could work something out to share more of like average daily updates, like, oh, there's a lot of smog going on, or, you know, there's a crash on the 405, or, you know, something like that. So he really found a way to kind of make that partnership and create this tool so that way it was easy for LAPD to share that information with radio stations.
Is there a threshold that triggers a SIG alert in terms of the degree of backup or closure?
Yes. So, you know, now today, SIG alerts are issued by the CHP. So it's no longer the LAPD running this. Now, and it's mainly online too. SIG alerts, the kind of general understanding of their definition is that it's any unplanned event that causes the closing of at least one lane of traffic for 30 minutes or more.
All right. One lane of traffic for 30 minutes or more. And Lloyd Sigmund lived to be 95. We lost him about 20 years ago. And he was apparently quite proud of his invention, understandably so, to the point where people seeing him driving around town would be aware of it.
Yes. I mean, I imagine how great that is. Like, you create this new piece of technology. It's named after you. I would flaunt it, too. Apparently, he was really known to drive around in a cream-colored Lincoln Continental Coupe, and he had a vanity license plate that said SIG Alert on it. So if you ever saw that around, that was that creator.
I love it, because you know so many people, Caitlin, would say to him, oh, SIG Alert, that's funny, that's a witty vanity plate. And then his response could be, well, I actually invented the SIG Alert. My last name's Sigmund. That would be a great thing to,
what a flex,
to be able to add. That is the ultimate flex in Los Angeles, certainly. We're talking with Caitlin Hernandez, LA Explained reporter for LAist, about the piece they've written for LAist.com titled, If You Live in LA, the term SIG Alert is way too familiar, but why is it called that? And that's what we're learning about. One of the things that that you write about, Caitlin, is a serious train derailment of the Santa Fe line back in January of 1956. And share with us what happened in response to that collision.
Right. Yes, definitely. So, you know, some people say that this might have been the first more like traffic focused use of a SIG alert. But I'm not too sure about that. But what happened on that day in January 1956, there was that big train wreck, like you said, and they used the SIG alert system to put an ask out for, you know, doctors and nurses and just medical personnel to respond, because they weren't sure how bad it was. It was a pretty, I think, traumatic crash for LA County. 30 people were killed and 117 were injured. So pretty high numbers, very impactful and tough. But what happened when they put that call out for the SIG alert, because it was going on the radio waves to so many people, a lot of people responded. You had medical personnel, you had priests who were asked to come, and then, you know, nosy onlookers, those looky-loos who like to show up to a place where they don't need to go, and they clogged the roads. So in a way, the SIG alert system, you know, as much as we know it today, is like a way to warn you of traffic. In that time, it actually created a big traffic jam.
We're talking with Caitlin Hernandez about their piece, If You Live in LA, the term SIG alert is way too familiar, but why is it called that? And I love hearing about Lloyd Sigmund of KMPC 710 Radio. It's now the ESPN affiliate in Los Angeles. But at the time, KMPC was a music radio station and what they called full service, a full news department, and a lot of traffic. And Lloyd Sigmund, their executive VP, came up with the SIG alert. And, you know, this is the same era when Los Angeles television, particularly KTLA, was making huge advances as well. Klaus Landsberg, who was the head of engineering for KTLA Channel 5 television, came up with so many advancements for doing live remote broadcasts and being able to transmit the video signal wirelessly to be able to cover live events like the tragedy of Kathy Fiscus falling into the well in San Marino, was now the football field at San Marino High School. And for hours and hours, people overnight following that. Los Angeles, in this post-war period, when so much of its population is growing, is also attracting some highly innovative individuals who, after their wartime service, turned their attention to telecommunications. And we were really the beneficiaries with those kinds of breakthroughs here in Southern California. Caitlin, thank you so much for sharing the story of Lloyd Sigmund. Just anything else real quickly to end on here?
Sure. I mean, I think a fun one is if you go to the Santa Monica Pier, the bumper cars are named after Sigmund. They're Sig Alert EV. So you can go hop on those and have a little trip down memory lane.
Caitlin, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Caitlin Hernandez, LA Explained reporter for LAist.com and LAist 89.3. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up on Film Week, our critics will tell us about Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, starring Paul Rudd and Carrie Coon. And yes, you'll get appearances from Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Ernie Hudson, and Annie Potts. Also, the Catholic convent set horror film Immaculate, starring Sydney Sweeney, and Roadhouse. Remember the 1989 Patrick Swayze original? Jake Gyllenhaal and Conor McGregor team up in the new Roadhouse. We'll hear what our critics say about those films. That's coming up in about...
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
20 minutes. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, and you know it's Food Friday. And wow, the studio smells incredible right now as we have the creations of chefs Brett Thompson and Lucy Thompson Ramirez with us. Brett is the host of Taste, Masters of Taste, as is Lucy, and co-founder of the restaurant Pez Cantina in downtown Los Angeles. Lucy and Chef Brett, who have done this incredible job of bringing goodies to us today, are the stars of Masters of Taste, which will be in the Rose Bowl Sunday, April 7th, from 3 to 7 p.m. Proceeds, all of them directly benefiting Union Station Homeless Services, our next door neighbor here on Raymond Avenue in Pasadena. Chefs, thank you so much. It's great to have you with us today. We appreciate it. Chef Lucy, let me start with you and just briefly tell us about Masters of Taste and what's going to be there for the attendees.
Well, Masters of Taste is a great show to participate in. Like you said, 100% of the proceeds help Union Station Homeless Services. You can purchase your tickets at mastersoftastela.com. It is a fabulous event where you can feel confident that 100% of every dollar that is raised is going towards a good cause while enjoying amazing food and beverages.
And the field of the Rose Bowl is where this is done, right? So you're right there where the big games are played.
Absolutely. You get to be on the field. And this year, Brett and I are converting the actual field two sides. One will be a Mexican village featuring Pez Cantina, and the other side will be a seafood village featuring Pez Coastal Kitchen, newly opened here on Raymond and Union in Old Pasadena.
Oh, great. Are you in the old Slater space? Then?
Exactly,
oh,
right on the corner there.
That's a great space.
Yeah,
historic
yeah.
building, a beautiful glass on the street there. That's a great location. When are you open there?
We opened up 7 weeks ago now.
Oh, great. 1 month.
All right. Very, very good. Chef Brett, let me ask you about the creations in front of me. What do we have here?
Good morning, Larry. So we've got a rendition of one of the dishes we do at the restaurant. It's a nori crisp, where we take in nori seaweed and we sandwich it between rice paper, and then we dry it and then we fry it into a chip. And on top of that, we've got spicy tuna tartare and a little bit of avocado labneh.
This is fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you. And then the sweet there is one of Austin's favorites as well. Last time I saw him, he tried that. It's an olive oil and lemon cake. It's got pistachio, mascarpone cream, and a little bit of kumquat and blackberry.
Wow. I have tried this one?
Yeah.
Oh, I see why he likes it so much. That is tremendous.
Thank you.
I'm sure he's very jealous. So share with us about the different influences on your cooking, maybe with these two items as representative of that.
Yeah. So you can definitely see there's a wide variety of ingredients there. And I think our new location in Pasadena, Pez Coastal Kitchen, we're able to, so downtown where it is Baja California Mexican, here it's kind of global. It's really seasonal seafood, although we do a lot of different, besides seafood. But it allows us to do, for me to sort of play with a lot of the ingredients and stuff I've done in the past. I lived in Lebanon, for example, on and off for 10 years. And so you'll see a lot of Lebne, for example, and grains and olives and olive oil and stuff. And then, a couple of years in Europe. And so you'll see a little bit of Italian. You see a little bit of French. And, it's really a way for us to really have a good time with seasonal products and, really just show off what we like to do.
What, and either one of you can answer this, but what are the challenges in a space as big as that space on Raymond and Union on the northwest corner? You have a lot of tables there. And so I'm wondering, how do you keep at that level? Because you're not doing, just burgers like a Slater's, the previous occupant. You're doing highly creative food where you really have to have solid control. How do you do that in a large space?
Yeah, good question. So, taking over a space like that, you've got to be able to, they say that, the empty seat in a restaurant is the most expensive seat. So we got to, be able to get as many people as there as we can. But also, we also want to have the level of the food as high as possible. At the same time, we want to be able to, have it approachable and not too out there and not, it's a fine line. Price point's got to be right there. We don't want to be that restaurant where it's just only a special occasion. We want people to go there, a couple times a week for happy hour, for corporate events, for with their friends. We've also got a beautiful, beautiful bar up against that brick
wall. It is a great bar.
Yeah, that building was built in 1896. It's a gorgeous
space. Horses went up and down those streets with carriages.
Yeah, it's really great. So, it's really just providing really just a fun, inviting second home for us. I mean, we want people to feel like they're walking into our dining room at our house when they come in there and just welcome them with loving arms and great food and drink.
And Lucy, what Brett's talking about a lot is sort of, the challenges of the business, because you're creative people, but you're running a business. You might well have investors, I don't know, that you're working with, and so you have group input. How do you manage all of that business side and then the creative hat at the same time?
Well, like you said, we wear a lot of different hats, and we're also parents. We have two boys, 14 and 17 years old, so it's a matter of just finding a balance in life. I think that being of service for us is at our core value, and I think that that's what really makes us have a good time operating a business, because we get to come in every day and practice our core value of being a family, of being of service, of serving people and breaking bread with people. So I think that that's what really keeps us going, and then you carve out some time at night to go through the numbers and do all of the accounting and do all of the bill paying. So it is a balance, but it is a labor of love. And I think that it's important for us to continue to support small businesses, because as small business owners, we do wear a lot of hats, and we rely on the people to continue to support us to have a success.
In what is such a competitive and challenging business, and has to be mission-driven, as you're describing. We're talking with Lucy Thompson Ramirez, Brett Thompson. We're talking with them. They're the host of Masters of Taste, which is a fundraiser for Union Station Homeless Services in Pasadena. The event is coming up at the Rose Bowl Sunday, April 7th, from 3 to 7 p.m. Full proceeds going to Union Station Homeless Services, the nonprofit that has been here in Pasadena for over 50 years. Brett, just share with us a bit about what you like about food festivals like this, as someone who I'm sure is always looking for good ideas in cooking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Well, it's nice to be able to get out of the regular day-to-day, get out in the, you know, especially on the Rose Bowl when you're on the field. It's one of our favorite events of the year, you know, and just to see all of our chef friends and people from around town and be able to collaborate and, you know, just have a good time, kind of check out from the restaurant day. And, you know, this is a great, we love, this is one of our favorite events of the year.
You do quite a few events.
We do, I would say, 5 of these kind of events a year.
Wow.
We get hit up a lot for these events, but it's tough because we got to really pick and choose where our marketing dollars go. But this is, you know, one of our favorites, and I think it's for an amazing cause. And just being out there, it's gorgeous, and you know, it gives us a chance to kind of display some new dishes, kind of you know, really come strong with our all-star dishes. And again, I think it's just nice to be out there with all of our chef friends and people in the industry.
Yeah. And you know, you were speaking, Lucy, to just all the things you've got going on in your life. And I'm always so impressed when you have couples who are running businesses that are as demanding as what you two are doing and being creative at it and handling all this. Congratulations to you for, you know, maintaining the relationship and also the business, because you can't let one or the other lag, of course.
Yeah.
That's thank you, Larry.
Very tough.
Yeah, we're celebrating our 22nd anniversary together, so we've weathered the storm.
Congratulations.
Thank
very,
you.
Very good. Thank you both for coming in. Congratulations on the success with your businesses, with Pez Baja Cantinas, the downtown location, correct?
Correct.
And then the brand new Pez that's in Old Pasadena, the corner of Raymond and Union, northwest corner in that gorgeous historic building. And again, they are the hosts, both of them, Brett Thompson and Lucy Thompson Ramirez, a Masters of Taste, which is raising money for Union Station Homeless Services, Sunday, April 7th, 3 to 7 p.m. at the Rose Bowl, right there on the field. And a chance for you to purchase tickets for that event. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Larry.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3.
Harole is your connection to Los Angeles. Get to know its history.
The 1920s were a huge boom time in Los Angeles, and downtown was just exploding.
Its politics.
It's the biggest local prosecutor's office in the country.
And its food.
Korean spices with like a hint of sweetness.
And just everything we love about LA. Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com, and she's also the co-host of the Breakfast All Day YouTube and podcast series. As well with us this week, film critic for the Christian Science Monitor, Peter Rayner. And we begin with Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, the film directed by Gil Kenan, who also co-wrote the screenplay with Jason Reitman. You might recall back in 1984, the first of the Ghostbusters was directed by Jason's father, Ivan Reitman. Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, Peter.
Well, it's been 40 years since the first one, and the time flies when you're not always having fun, as in this movie. I didn't see the last one. I just thought it was, you know, kind of missable. And the one before, the all-female
one. Yeah, the all-women one.
I thought was not good. And I don't think this is particularly good either. It harkens back to all of the other Ghostbusters movies, especially the first one. And you've got, you know, Ernie Hudson and Dan Aykroyd and Annie Potts and Bill Murray as a 3-second cameo in it, you know, pretty much. And, you know, so there's a lot of self-referential backslapping in this film. But overall, I think the problem for me with the film is that there's too much going on. It's like the filmmakers couldn't figure out what story to tell or what couple of stories to tell, so they just threw everything into the mix. Paul Rudd is this sort of stepfathery guy who's paired with Carrie Coon, they're very affable actors, and you know, their kids are it reminded me a little bit of Spy Kids, this whole movie. You know, I mean, it's a kind of cheesiness to it, and a sense in which, you know, they're just sort of throwing everything against the wall to see what hits, and the whole Frozen Empire thing doesn't really play out very well either. The big climax, I thought, was kind of a bust. It's nice to see Dan Aykroyd, you know, playing the occult bookseller role, and Patton Oswalt's very funny. And, you know, there's funny cameos throughout. I'll just say, you know, it may not be totally in bounds, but, you know, Bill Murray is maybe in the movie for 5 minutes. I think he worked for 2 days. He probably got millions and millions of dollars for this. I don't blame him for that, but he could have put a little bit more into the role. It looks like he doesn't want to be in this movie, and you know, for a paycheck performance, one expects a little bit more, particularly given the lineage of this film.
Ghostbusters: Frozen Empire, Christy.
Yeah, I did see Ghostbusters: Afterlife, and I think you have to understand why Paul Rudd and Carrie Coon and McKenna Grace and Finn Wolfhard are now in New York taking over the firehouse, busting ghosts. This is a better job than that film of blending the old and the new. I hated Afterlife. I thought it was all just wallowing in nostalgia, just shamelessly like lingering on, ooh, look, there's the car. Ooh, look, they're wearing proton packs. Here's stuff you know. Here's your childhood all over again. This is a better job of moving in a more sprightly way between the old and the new. But the McKenna Grace character is super interesting. She's this science whiz kid. These are the descendants of Spengler, and so the Harold Ramis character. And so she wants to bust ghosts with the family, but she's 15, so she can't. That's one of many, many different plots going on here. It is too crammed. There is too much story. The whole reason that things get icy, it gets explained to us, but is extremely convoluted, and I don't totally understand it or think it works.
I don't
think
they did either.
Yeah, and then how do you fight it? Like the thing with Kumail Nanjiani, how does that work? But Paul Rudd and Carrie Coon, as you say, are really likable together. What they do with Carrie Coon, though, is a travesty. Like one of the best actresses working today, deeply talented, so versatile, and she's just relegated to being like the no-nonsense harried mom here. Sort of a thankless role for her. Yeah, this is okay. I gave it 2 stars out of 4 on RogerEbert.com. It's better than its predecessor, but like, can we just not wallow in nostalgia? Can we just move on? They have the IP. Take that and do something new with it.
We're talking about Ghostbusters: Frozen Empire, directed by Gil Cannon, who co-wrote it with Jason Reitman. It's rated PG-13. It's in wide release. The horror film Immaculate stars Sydney Sweeney and Alvaro Morte. Michael Mohan directed. Andrew Lobel is the screenwriter. Christy, please tell us about Immaculate.
This movie is nutty, and it's going to make people very, very angry. I think there's imagery, Catholic.
You say that with delight.
There's Catholic iconography here, and the way that it is used, I think, is going to anger a lot of people, but that comes down the road. First, you have Sydney Sweeney as this devout young woman named Cecilia. She grew up outside of Detroit, but she is traveling to this remote nunnery in Italy, very scenic, very craggy. We know from the opening sequence something horrible has happened there, but she is young and plucky and full of promise, and she shows up, and this is her calling. And she hasn't realized this, but we realize from the very beginning that this is a weird place and something's going on here. She becomes pregnant. This is not a spoiler.
Given the title, right, this is not a shock.
It's the titular role, as they say, in Lady Bird. She becomes pregnant. And so the question is, how did this happen? She's a virgin. She's a nun. Is an immaculate conception. So they all revere her as this sacred vessel because of it, but darker stuff happens from there. It's pretty moody in like a gothic kind of horror way for a while. There are way too many jump scares given how effective the atmosphere is. And then in the third act, it goes totally crazy in ways that I wish it had for a while leading up to it. They sort of save it all up, and there's one tremendous long single take where the camera is just on Sydney Sweeney's face, and it is gory and intense, and you're going to hold your breath wondering what's going to happen. They go to places that are very daring, and I applaud them for it.
Immaculate, the horror film that we're talking about, Peter.
Yeah, well, the conception of this movie is very gory. Apparently, this was like a passion project of Sydney Sweeney's for some time. It's a little odd to think of it in those terms, but I guess to each his own or her own. I wasn't nuts about it. I thought there are way too many jump scares in it, and you can see them coming, and even when you jump, it's too much. And at its best, I think it's sort of like a cross between. I mean, there's certainly a lot of Rosemary's Baby in here. There's also sort of a cross between The Nun Story and Eraserhead.
That's the quote of the day, Peter.
Yeah, you should not see this movie if you're pregnant, which is what they said about Eraserhead as well. There's a lot of stuff going on in this movie. But it all seems to be on a sort of horror level, a gory, gross-out horror level with, all of this, Catholic symbology in it. But it doesn't go very deep. And I guess it's unfair to think in this way, but I was hoping that it would be more like Carrie, which I thought was also really scary, really bloody, really powerful, but also had this whole other undertone,
psychological aspect,
The mother, the fundamentalist mother and Carrie and all of the Catholic imagery in that really resonated in a way that here is just sort of pro forma. So, I think it, for what it is, it's going to get people jumping out of their seats, and the scare factor is there. But it does, I think, go over the line in ways that aren't particularly profitable.
What did you think of Sydney Sweeney's performance?
She's great in this. She can do anything. I mean, between the screwball comedy of Anyone But You, and then if you saw the movie Reality on HBO, where she played Reality Winner, a totally stripped down minimalist performance, this, like that, relies a lot on her face, on her eyes, on her being able to hold the frame and carry us with her as she goes through this increasingly intense realm. So I think she's very good. What'd you think?
Yeah, I thought she was pretty good. I having just seen her brief before in the Saturday Night Live hosting and all of these, some comments against that because most of the skits were based on how she looks. I think in this movie she certainly doesn't play off of that. It's an entirely different realm for her. And I think, she does a good job. It helps in this kind of scenario if you're somewhat not blank-faced, but not overly emotive and tipping off the audience all the time as to how you're feeling.
We're talking about the film Immaculate. It's a horror film starring Sydney Sweeney, Michael Mohan, the director, Andrew Lobelle, the screenwriter. It's rated R. You can see Immaculate in select theaters. Coming up, we'll hear what our critics have to say about Roadhouse, a new version of that film. It stars Jake Gyllenhaal and Conor McGregor. We'll also hear about the Australian crime mystery Limbo, starring Simon Baker, and a biography looking at the life of Shirley Chisholm, who was the first Black congresswoman and the first Black woman to run for president of the United States. That all comes up on Film Week here on LAist 89.3. Back with you in just a moment. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. Larry Mantle with critics Peter Rayner and Christy Lemire. Mind you, in case you missed our two films we reviewed to this point, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire or the horror film Immaculate with Sydney Sweeney, you can hear in their entirety the full time of Film Week wherever you get your podcasts or at LAist.com. Next up is Roadhouse. We have a new version of the film. The original goes back to 1989. The new Roadhouse stars Jake Gyllenhaal and Conor McGregor. It's directed by Doug Liman, written by Anthony Bagarossi and Chuck Mondry. Christy?
This movie is so fun because it's a Roadhouse movie that knows it's a Roadhouse movie, and it has so much fun with that. The 89 Roadhouse starring Patrick Swayze is so of its time and so serious and so macho, and this just plays with all of that, and it's hilarious, and I am shocked at how much I enjoyed myself because I'm like, does the world really need a new Roadhouse movie? And yes, apparently we do, and here it is. I wish it were playing in theaters. It's only streaming on Prime Video. Doug Liman, who directed it, was very vocal about the fact that he thought it was going to be playing theatrically as well. And I wish it were. It played at South by Southwest. This will play like gangbusters under the right circumstances. So Jake Gyllenhaal is Dalton. Not unlike Patrick Swayze, he is a notoriously legendary, mythical figure for his prowess as a fighter. And we see him in the beginning. Here he's a UFC fighter in the beginning. That's slightly different. But the spine of this is exactly the same as the original Roadhouse. He is asked to go to this rowdy dive bar and kind of get things in order because there's just too much fighting going on. Here, the owner is Jessica Williams, who is so funny. She has great chemistry with Jake Gyllenhaal here. And so he's got to go down to the Florida Keys to this rowdy place. And the process, he crosses paths with the local bad guy who runs things. Here he's played by Billy Magnuson, who's very funny. He once again falls in love with a doctor. Here she's played by Gabriella Melchior, who's very good. What is different here is this movie has a really cheeky, understated sense of humor. It sneaks up on you. Jake Gyllenhaal as Dalton is so funny and like smart and clever in understated ways and kind of playful with the guys that he's about to beat up. And over again, I just laughed out loud. I really, really enjoyed this. Doug Liman has a history of doing some really big action movies like The Bourne Identity and it's now called Live, Die, Repeat with Tom Cruise and Mr. and Mrs. Smith. So you've got stuff with like exploding boats. You know, if you want that, that is there. But a lot of folks are going to tune into this to watch Jake Gyllenhaal and Conor McGregor beat each other up. I am not a UFC fan. Larry, I don't know if you are a UFC fan.
No, really? No.
A lot of people, though, are going to be very excited about this. I didn't necessarily need that. And I would say the last half hour of this entirely two-hour-long movie gets a little repetitive for me. But I had a lot of fun. It's really silly and playful.
Well, and as you say, some viewers, that's what they're going to be waiting for, the fights.
Right.
That's really what sells the ticket for them.
Does Conor McGregor have a future as an actor?
As an actor, he is a great fighter. I will say, if you want to see naked Conor McGregor,
well elided. Yeah, right.
There's a lot of naked Conor McGregor. But, you know, he shows up and does what he has to do.
So. We're talking about Roadhouse. This is the third Roadhouse movie, the original 1989. And then there was a direct-to-DVD sequel in 2006. Doug Liman directing, starring Jake Gyllenhaal and Conor McGregor. Roadhouse is streaming on Amazon Prime Video. Limbo, an Australian crime drama, stars Simon Baker and Natasha Wanaganin. The film was written and directed by Ivan Sen. Peter, what did you think of Limbo?
This is a strong movie. It's shot entirely in black and white. It's very austerely shot. It's set in a remote area of the outback that was sort of an opal mining town, and now it's just sort of, you know, full of craters and caves where people mostly live because it's so hot. Simon Baker is a detective who visits the community because there's a 20-year-old cold case. A young woman was disappeared. An Aboriginal woman, indigenous woman, went missing 20 years ago, and it was never solved, and the case was, you know, just sort of set aside. And he's there to see if they can reopen the case, not so much solve it, but just even get to the point of should we reopen it. And he's a very complex character. He's, a former a drug officer who we first seen in the movie. He's shooting up in his quote hotel room. So he visits the family of the disappeared woman, who really want nothing to do with him. When he sees the brother, the first wonderfully played by Rob Collins, Collins says to him, "I don't talk to police, especially white ones." You know, so that tells you a lot. And the movie doesn't overemphasize the white supremacy aspect of all of this, but it's very much in the DNA of this film. And in going around and talking to the different family members, you get a real overview of the struggles that these indigenous people have gone through. And Natasha Wanganin, who's the sister, is particularly good, I think, in her performance. Mm. It's a strong movie. It really there are very few movies that I've seen from Australia that really play this story up about, you know, the horrors of this. The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, I think, was a really good one. But this one is really powerful.
Limbo is the film we're talking about. Christy?
I thought it was great, too. It's so strikingly shot because it is shot in black and white, as Peter mentioned, and because the topography is so stark, it feels like it all takes place on the moon. Like, it's a beautiful bleakness to it, and, you know, it's so barren and so arid and so spare that, you know, if there's a single car driving down a road, there's just nothing on either side of it as far as the eye can see. But then there are these caves, and people live in the caves, and so the use of lighting over and over again, there's establishing shots where I was like, wow, that's beautiful, wow, that's beautiful, because either the light's coming through the cave from the outside, or they're using shadow in a way that is very ominous and mysterious. And Simon Baker is great in this. I've never seen him do anything like this. He's an incredibly handsome man, and he is so stripped down with like a buzzed haircut and all these tats. He looks like Bryan Cranston in Breaking Bad. Does he not? He has like all these neck tats,
yeah, he's
and the glasses.
Unrecognizable. Mentalist, forget it, you know.
And intentionally, they don't let us see him full on until almost the very end. You see him, his head's down a lot. There's a lot going on with self-confidence and his sense of purpose, and you see him from the side quite a bit, and eventually you do see him full on, and it's striking. When you finally see him in full, you realize that there has been an occurrence that has come to him, and he's not a white savior here. Quite the opposite. I think that he maybe becomes something close to saved in his, you know, interactions with these families.
Yeah, you don't really... You know, you discover about halfway through that you probably aren't going to figure out who did what. You know, it's not that kind of movie. It's not a whodunit. It's much more incisive than that. I saw the film recently on the big screen. Mark Johnson, who was not involved but is a friend of Simon Baker, did an interview. And Johnson said at one point, you know, I watched this movie in black and white, and it never occurred to me really that, hey, this is black and white, because the setting is so austere that you just think of it. I mean, even if it was shot in color, it would be black and white, you know, which I thought was a really good point.
We're talking about Limbo. Simon Baker stars, Ivan Sen, the writer-director. It's unrated. You can see it at Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica. Shirley is a biopic about Shirley Chisholm, first black congresswoman and the first black woman to run for president of the United States. Regina King stars John Ridley, who's been a guest on Air Talk with us a number of times over the years, is the writer and director of Shirley. Christy.
This is a very solidly made, well-cast, well-acted biopic. It doesn't really do a whole lot that's terribly different in terms of structure, in terms of tone, but it doesn't really have to. It's such an inspiring story, and it wasn't that long ago. It was 52 years ago, but still necessary to hear about this woman's bravery and her trailblazing history that she's left for so many other people in politics. So Regina King is Shirley Chisholm. We see her, you know, begin her congressional career, that freshman picture on the steps there at Congress, and she stands out. It's all white men and her, but from the very beginning, she's totally undaunted, but in ways that are like quietly powerful, right? Like there's this quiet kind of simmering, bubbling, not fury, but like sense of purpose, like sense of necessity to be a voice for the people in Brooklyn in her district. And just what happens when she is persuaded to run for president and does not have a chance, and she knows this, and that's not the point, though. It's like what this means in terms of representation, in terms of giving hope to other people. It's this fantastic supporting cast. You have Lucas Hedges, Lance Reddick in one of his last roles, Andre Holland, Terrence Howard, like everyone is great in this. The production and the costume design are spot on. She looks just like Shirley Chisholm. It's amazing. And then John Ridley, who won an Oscar for 12 Years a Slave, does some interesting things in terms of like framing, like where he will place her in the frame in terms of trying to indicate her isolation in a way that's quiet, in a way that's artful. So he makes some interesting artistic decisions here that are unexpected, but it's kind of just a solid biopic.
We'll come back and hear what Peter Rayner has to say about the biopic Shirley, starring Regina King as Shirley Chisholm, John Ridley, the writer-director. It's rated PG-13. It's streaming on Netflix. We'll also hear about the documentary Remembering Gene Wilder. It's Film Week on LA. It's 89.3, and we remind you the full hour of Film Week available to you wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to it there or listen at LAist.com. It's Film Week on LA, it's 89.3. Larry Mantle with Christy Lemire and Peter Rayner. We're right in the midst of a review of the biopic Shirley, starring Regina King as the first Black Congresswoman, Shirley Chisholm, and the first Black woman to run for President of the United States. John Ridley, the writer-director. Peter, what did you think?
Well, you know, it's an admirable effort, and certainly Shirley Chisholm deserves a biopic. The problem I have with this film is similar to the one that I had with Rustin recently, with Coleman Domingo. You've got some terrific performances, including a terrific central performance, but somehow it just seems like there's a very dutiful aspect to the way the story is told. You know, all right, then this happened. You know, they had this blow up. You know, there was this argument, and you know, it's all kind of sketched out in a way that made me want to feel as if, you know, I'd like to see a documentary about her life, because I think that would be much more involving and real. And you know, and when they do show pictures of her, of the real Shirley Chisholm at the end, you know, you feel like, aha, you know, that's the real person, even though Regina King is so good in it. I mean, the whole cast, it's marvelous cast. You know, there's also Brian Stokes Mitchell is in it, and others that Christy mentioned. It's but I do feel that it doesn't really... The political stuff, all of the political infighting that goes on, seemed to me less interesting than the domestic drama that she had with her husband. You know, Michael Cherry plays her husband, and the scenes between them and the sort of growing separation between them, I thought was in some ways the most interesting and emotional part of the movie. And I wish there'd been more of that. But, you know, instead we have a kind of, you know, Cook's tour of her political life with all of the signposts laid out. And, you know, it's worth seeing, and the performances are strong. I just feel it's a little bit too, you know, cookie cutter.
We're talking about Shirley, the biopic starring Regina King, rated PG-13. It's streaming on Netflix. The documentary Remembering Gene Wilder is directed by Rob Frank. And I just want to say as a premise, Gene Wilder is one of my favorite guests. Aww. In all the years I've been on Air Talk. He and I had such an incredible conversation in studio, and it was just like everything else kind of fell away. And at the end of it, he was the last interview of the show. He sat, you know, right where you are, Peter, and he said, "That's the best interview I have ever had." Aww. And he stayed for half an hour afterwards, and we just talked. And he gave me a hug at the end before he left. One of the most memorable experiences I've ever had with a guest on Air Talk was Gene Wilder.
Wow.
So how was the documentary?
Go ahead, Peter.
Well, he mentions you, Larry.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Dedicated to Larry Mantle.
Yeah, right.
Well, you know, it's as a documentary, it's as a piece of work, I thought it was, you know, pretty okay. You know, there's a lot of... mostly, you know, laudatory. It's a love fest. You know, there's a lot of talking heads with a lot of the usual suspects, of course, Mel Brooks and, you know, Carol Kane and others. That's all interesting, and it's good to see them all there. I mean, I love Gene Wilder. I thought he remains one of my favorite performers. His meltdowns, no one could do hysterics like Gene Wilder. You know, I mean, starting with the producers. My blue blanket, you know, everything. I mean, most of that is in this movie. Some, like, can start the revolution without me is not in here. You know, they don't really, you know, they don't go, he was married four times. They don't really deal with the first two. They don't deal much with his career in the 90s. The anecdote is given that when he was a little kid, his mother was very sick. She had a bad heart. And the doctor said to young Gene, you know, don't upset her in any way. you know, or she might die, which is a horrible thing to lay on a kid, you know. So, you know, calling Dr. Freud, you know, that's probably one reason why you became a comic was, you know, to make everybody laugh. But at the same time, this kind of hysterical, you know, craziness that's inside of him that keeps coming out, I think was sort of a reaction, you know, to all of that, you know, don't upset people, you know. But just to see the clips of him and Young, and also, you know, he co-wrote Young Frankenstein.
Yeah, that's right.
And what comes out in the movie is the putting on the Ritz number with Peter Boyle was Gene Wilder's idea.
Really? I assumed that was Mel Brooks's.
Me too. And he says that Mel Brooks thought it was a terrible idea. And then when they said, well, all right, we'll do it. And then he said, it turns out it's the best thing in the movie. Yeah.
We're talking about Remembering Gene Wilder, the documentary. Christy?
It's a very lovely film. It's very warm and affectionate and so many great anecdotes. And I came to appreciate his artistry on a whole different level, just as an actor, as a human being, where he found his inspiration from. It's a lot of interviews with him. And also his audiobook provides a through line as the narration, which is nice, because it makes you feel like he's taking your hand and walking you through this. So what happens so often when there's a documentary about somebody, you know, when the person, him or herself, is involved, or when the family estate gives the okay, it tends to be, you know, kind kind of kid gloves. This is not in any way uncovering anything shocking or inappropriate about Gene Wilder. This is a loving tribute to his career. I learned so much about moments that we just take for granted in film. The introduction to him in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the way that he walks out, like what that came from, how he ended up in Blazing Saddles, like all these roles that are iconic roles of his, we learn great little details about. And they also talk about just as a presence, like those eyes. I'm sure Larry, looking across the table at him here, like those eyes must have been mesmerizing to you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he was such a companionable performer. A lot of great comics, are basically acting, doing solos, and they don't really work with the other person because they're doing their thing. But with Gene Wilder, you know, he paired so marvelously with
Zero Mostel,
with Richard Pryor. You know, I mean, he just teamed with anybody well.
Yeah, we're talking about Remembering Gene Wilder, the documentary directed by Rob Frank. You can see it at Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A. and their Town Center 5 location in Encino. It's unrated. Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World is a comedy from Romania. The film is screening at Lemley's Royal in West L.A. Peter?
Yeah, this is a very strange movie by this occult director, Radu Jude, who's got a lot of experience. Jude, who's had a lot of festival exposure. It's set in Bucharest. The woman named Angela is a sort of an Uber driver, but she also works at this multinational company that is trying to put out a kind of safety video for their people about, you know, what you shouldn't do in the workplace. And so she goes around and visits all these people who are all, you know, in wheelchairs and whatnot from workplace injuries, and films their stories. And then the company is going to pick the one that's most likely to, you know, get people to. It's a very strange movie because it's sort of bifurcated between that story and an actual footage from a 1981 Romanian film that was shot in color as opposed to the black and white stuff that isn't. And it interplays the two in ways that are very consciously Godardian. This film is one of, you know, I thought Jean-Luc Godard's influence had been kind of waning in the art world, but it's back with a real force in this movie. It's worth seeing. There's a 45-minute single take scene at the end, filming one of the guys in a wheelchair for this mock video. That is quite extraordinary and is sort of typical of Romanian movies like RMN, which seem to, you know, like have half-hour single takes, you know. But I should also say, just for a tourism point of view, there ought to be a few movies from Romania that are scenic. I mean, this, you know,
it's pretty bleak.
I've never seen a movie from Romania that did not look incredibly bleak. Just saying.
Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World, Romanian comedy, written and directed by Radu Jude. It's at Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A. It's unrated. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. Peter Rayner, Christy Lemire, our critics.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiots and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.